Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here, along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend's edition. We're going to be focusing a lot again on the resource sector and more active investing in juniors and even some mid-tier stocks for all the investors that, unfortunately, we have been watching again a bit of a broad sell-off continuing for a lot of these stocks. Throughout the week, we did focus again on a lot of company updates because, look, there's still a lot of good news coming out of these companies, and it's a great time to be really reanalyzing the companies you're looking at and your portfolio for, hopefully, when some more interest comes back into the precious metal sector. I'm excited about these first two segments because we are introducing a relatively new guest on the show. We've had him on once before. His name is Dave Lotan. He is president of LHI, a family investment office, also pretty well known as being a large investor in the resource space. Dave, I want to start off with a little bit of your background and really what brought you into the commodity space, especially in terms of the junior space and some of the junior stocks. Let's start there, please.
Sure. Corey, thanks very much for having me on. So my background is in finance. I was a chartered accountant with Pricewaterhouse, which I guess is now PricewaterhouseCoopers. And for a bunch of random reasons, I was streamed into structured finance and derivatives, which were a bit of a hot topic during the late 1990s after the Orange County Pension Fund went bankrupt, and companies like Metal Gesellschaft, which was a commodities trading company out of Germany, had difficulties with futures and options contracts. And so there was a lot of focus on that at the board level, and auditing firms at the time were required to do a lot of work on the derivative portfolios of companies that were using these sort of levered products to hedge out risks that were not central to their business, that were commodity related and were embedded in their commercial activity. So I worked with some of the Canadian banks that were using swaps and interest rate options to hedge off the mismatch between their liabilities and their assets. And I worked with some of the oil refineries in Canada that were using futures and options to hedge off the difference between their cost of crude and their eventual proceeds from the sale of natural gas and heating oil and that sort of thing. And I got hired away by a hedge fund called Polar Capital, which was running a small mortgage bank in Canada that was in some difficulty. It was sourcing most of its money from the capital markets and using derivatives to hedge off mismatches. And so I did get a little bit lucky. We turned that business around and it got sold. And I then started a business in partnership with them, which was involved in other leveraged opportunities in Canadian credit markets. I sold that business to one of the big Canadian banks in 2007 and briefly retired, but then went over to one of the big pension funds with the ostensible task of building a similar business, but much larger in size. And shortly after that, the mortgage crisis began in the United States. Actually, it started in Canada. We had a bunch of asset-backed commercial paper that froze and couldn't be rolled here. And it became obvious that these structured finance techniques, these leverage techniques, were not going to work anymore. So I hung around that pension fund doing some distressed opportunities until 2008, and then decided that I couldn't run my own money and run their money at the same time. So I retired and focused for a while on banks, U.S. banks and insurance companies, which were the distressed opportunity of the day. I really owned a small amount of exposure in gold and commodities at the time. That trade played out over a couple of years, and I eventually liquidated that portfolio. And then I walked right into what looked like a fantastic opportunity in Canadian juniors in about November of 2011, which, as you will both note, was about 4 years too early. So I spent quite some time thinking about all of the mistakes that I was making and adding to them, deconstructing this business. And when it was almost too late, I decided it was a fantastic contrarian opportunity, and have since 2015 spent most of my time in commodity related juniors. I think that's why we're here today.
Well, Dave, after your traditional background in financing and managing pension funds and being involved with that side of the equation, what mental shift did you go through that caused you to take a deeper dive in the commodity sector? Why did you decide that gold, silver, phosphates, base metals were the place to start looking for unseen opportunity?
Sure. Well, my investing framework, I would say, is based on three things, really. The first and most important thing to think about in making any investment decision is who's going to buy it from you. And it follows from that, you might be interested in who's selling it to you. And I would put that under the broader umbrella of flow. And I think that one of the things that I recognized too late and was that by 2014, it became obvious that flows into Canadian stocks and especially Canadian resource-based stocks were completely negative and would be negative for quite some time. And that was because of the structure of the industry. Many of these companies were financed by sector-specific mutual funds in Canada, which had very high management expense ratios, very high management fees. And the whole world was moving over to ETFs. And as you both know, when, for instance, a precious metals fund begins to produce negative returns, it experiences redemptions, there's a massive mismatch between the, you know, daily liquidity that these funds offer their unit holders and the amount of time it takes for a mining project to come on stream. So there were massive structural mismatches in the way the business was being funded, which resulted in what I thought would be negative flows for quite some time. So flow was important to me. And psychology was important to me, and just the whole concept of entropy. And that's, you know, systems are always breaking down and being reorganized as new systems. And I guess in the world of commodities, sort of the apex example of that was the gold standard breaking down in 1971 and Nixon taking the U.S. Closing the gold window in the United States. And that led to the first time in history when there was no hard money in the global system, and led to some spectacular opportunities in commodities as a result of that during the 1970s. So that framework in my mind has been active ever since 1971. There was a long gold bear market after Volcker got in at the Fed and did some of the best work I've ever seen a central banker do, or I've ever, I suppose, read about a central banker doing. Inevitably, things began to go in a different direction. So from the 40,000-foot view, I've always believed that gold was going to go into a 1,000-year bull market after 1971. And, you know, maybe we don't have 1,000 years left on Earth. But unfortunately, it can go into bear markets that last for years. And it should be a cautionary tale for all of us that we had a 20-year bear market from 1981 or 82 to 2001, 2002, depending on when you think it peaked and when you think it bottomed. Within all of that, and assuming that you believe in that view, the sector itself has its own cycles within these large cycles. And I think it's fascinating that Barrick as a company was effectively built in the 1980s, just as gold was going into this great and historic bear market counter move to what I thought would be a very long bull market. So when you think about Arequipa being sold for $30 a share on the strength of Purina in 1996. Or when you think about Diamond Fields being sold for $4 billion in 97, or was it 96, during a year when nickel averaged $3.20 a pound. If you really, really take this sector apart, there are opportunities, big picture opportunities, and then there are many counter cycles and mini cycles within larger cycles.
Dave, let's get into some of the company specific stuff, because honestly, that's what a lot of people always want to hear. What's Dave buying? What is a big shareholder like yourself? What do you even look for in a company right now when, in all fairness, I think you need to be selective in this market?
So I think I've gone over 10% on three companies and gone in public domain on Fox River, which is a phosphate play in Northern Ontario, and Orion, which is a gold exploration company in Finland, and on CBG or Chibougamau Independent Mines, which had a bunch of old copper mines in the Chibougamau camp in Quebec. And so first and foremost, I want to buy into an ethical management team. And in general, where I've gone over 10% or where I've joined a board, it's because I think management is ethical. That if those conditions are not there, then it doesn't preclude me from making an investment, but it certainly informs the size of investment that I'm willing to make. And I wouldn't go in public domain if I didn't think management was trustworthy. There are lots of management teams out there that I think are highly conflicted, where I will still invest, but to get to that kind of size, I have to think that the people running the company have good intentions. And Orion was a great example. Mike and I had worked together for many years. He was an ethical guy. He wanted to make discoveries. There was a part of his business that he wasn't great at. That was awareness and promotion. But he was phenomenal at assembling property packages, and he was a great steward of investor capital. So I went over 10% and later joined the board to help him with the things that he didn't have the time to focus on or wasn't experienced at. With CBG, we're talking about copper assets. When I started my position in that company, I think I was able to buy about 9.9% of it at, let's say, a sub $2 million valuation. And we've seen these old brownfield camps in Quebec get reinvigorated, in the Abitibi, get reinvigorated on a regular basis. Red Lake was dead until Gold Eagle made a new discovery underneath the Bruce Channel at Cochenour. And from out of nowhere, I think it was called Southern Star Resources and one of Steve Roman's old companies came together. And a couple of years later, the whole thing got sold to Goldcorp for $1.5 billion. And there had been no developments in Red Lake since the discovery of the high-grade zone in the 1990s. And all of a sudden, this camp was producing, with no resource and only a few years worth of history, $1.5 billion acquisition. So when I thought about the Chibougamau camp and I thought about how fragmented it had been for most of its existence, I think it had 16 headframes in it at one point, and had been brought together briefly under Patino Mines. All of this came to an end when copper hit 50 cents in the 1990s, but really was out of business and in one crappy junior and mostly in bankruptcy during the next 20 or so years. I thought about this as a camp that could be the next Malartic potentially, or I suppose, well, the next Red Lake is a bit of a stretch. It's a copper gold camp, but it didn't even need to be those things. What it needed was to be a camp that had a lot more ore to give, where if it were united, and if it wasn't a camp that was the subject of premature production ambitions, if it was properly explored, you might have something like a Malartic outcome. And I think both of you know the history of Malartic and that it was a little high grade. It was a bunch of high grade underground mines that eventually was united by Osisko and turned into, and then they found the deeper porphyry underneath, and and turned it into a 500,000 ounce a year producer. But it took time, and it took consolidation, and it took years. And so CBG was, in my mind, that kind of an opportunity. And given the valuation that you're able to buy it at, which was sub $2 million at the time, you didn't even need it to have the market upside. And you know, it's moved in fits and starts since then, but it's obviously much more valuable than when I assembled my initial stake.
Well, Dave, there's about 1,000 interviews that I think all of us have heard where we ask people, you know, why do you pick the companies you pick and what gets your interest? And we hear team, we hear project, we hear jurisdiction, we hear capital. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, there's 1,000 different junior mining companies. So I'm curious, you know, when you peel back the layers, other than the normal talking points we always hear, what are you really looking for in a project? Is it the stage they're at, like an exploration stage or development stage? Mm-hmm. Is it an area mm-hmm. play? Or is there something else that you see? Because you've also had a history of uniting different projects and bringing together different teams, different assets, and forming better arrangements, or at least as an investor, seeing those things happening before others. So what's the real mm-hmm. value proposition that Dave Lotan looks at when you're analyzing mining stocks?
It's a very hard question to answer. And I'll tackle it, start with this way. So I'm sure you both remember Nevsun. And Nevsun in the early 2000s at one point was a 12-cent stock. And Bisha wasn't even in the company at that point in time. It was never consolidated. Bisha eventually came. It turned into some spectacular high-grade results, although in BMS and in a district that was very difficult to deal with. But the cycle came around, and the company was able to get project financing and get it into production. It might have peaked at $13 at one point before they ended up taking over Reservoir Capital for Timok, and then getting taken over themselves by, I think, I can't remember the name of the Chinese company that took it over. So this isn't an answer anyone will like, but when you're buying companies run by decent people that are cheap enough, and you're buying them at the bottom of the cycle, sometimes you just have to have the faith that what's going to be valuable is coming, even if it isn't there yet. My original stake in Orion started when the company wasn't in Finland. I think I got to 5% when Mike was just grinding his axe in Mexico. And I met him at the airport on the trip that when he came back, having been through a nightmare, having been held at gunpoint, having discovered a body on the property while touring Kinross at the time, who ceased to be even aware of the company for years until they came back into our Finland business. And we sat at the airport and talked about how the company was just going to have to write off its investment in Mexico and take the capital that it had and move on and look for other things. And so, as I said, it's not the answer that anyone wants to hear, but when you're in a sort of a massive counter-cyclical trade, especially in juniors, you have faith in the process in Vancouver and in Canada, where these companies go to zero. If they have money, they're able to buy assets very cheaply. That may revalue as the cycle turns. And if they don't, they may do an RTO or be combined to become part of something bigger, as happened with Ryan Gold and Corona Gold and Oban, which were all cash shells that I think off air we discussed the fact that I owned 7 or 9% of each one of them. They had cash. The sector didn't have cash. They combined with Eagle Hill and they became Osisko Mining. So sometimes if you're at that point in the cycle where cash is king and no one has cash, you might just buy cash at a discount. If the people managing the company are in your mind ethical and well-intentioned, you might buy cash for cash or some slight premium. Sometimes, as in the case of CBG, you're buying assets that trade for nothing, understanding that similar assets have been dramatically revalued in turning cycles. And sometimes you're buying leveraged opportunities. And I guess Claude Resources would be a fantastic example of that. I mean, the CB deposit, I think, had a lot of potential. Often, in the, you know, Richmont would be another great example, or Westome. These were just really, really rusty old underground operations that didn't make any money, that were just clattering along, getting by during a low commodity price environment. They had just enough debt to go bankrupt, and they all had discoveries in existing underground mines. And if you had the courage to go into those companies at the bottom of the cycle, you got the revaluation of their earning streams, and you got these fabulous high-grade discoveries, which convert into a lot of market cap very quickly. And of course, I guess Kirkland Lake would be a great example of that. But in theory, Kirkland Lake was never really in distress.
All right, Dave, we're going to wrap it up there. Really interesting comments. And I really like that look back in history and seeing how some of these now well-known companies have developed and grown and what it took to get them just a higher market cap and a project that really captured the attention of investors. We're going to have you back on the show again, Dave, because you do have some great insights in the market and, again, a very active investor in the space. So, Dave, appreciate your time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and we will chat again soon.
Many thanks for having me, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And the theme of this weekend show is really talking to private investors that are focused in the commodities or resource stocks, a lot in gold, to try to get their understanding, their feeling for this market that, unfortunately, especially for the stocks, has been pretty devastating over the last year. I know gold has only dropped, let's say, a little over 10% from its peak about a year ago. Some of these stocks, especially the juniors, they're 50, 60, 70% off some of their highs. So Shad and I right now are chatting with Richard Postma, aka Doc, another private investor in the precious metals space and one that has built up a very large following on our site in particular. Doc, I want to start off big picture here. Again, we look at the complete underperformance of the gold stocks and also the pullback in gold after a good run. Whether you argue that the bull market started in 2019 or back in 2015, either way, look, we've had a year of down action, and clearly investors have started in a large amount now turning away from the sector. Doc, what charts do you think are most important for precious metals investors to look at right now?
The most important charts, and I've said this right along, for the precious metals are the monthly charts. And when we got to a high last year in August, I mentioned I thought we were probably at a high and we would probably reverse that and start grinding lower over time. And we've done that. And what really scares me is how similar that chart right now looks like 2011-2012 chart. It's playing out almost exactly the same. I don't think it will, but right now you could almost superimpose those monthly charts going back to 2011 and 2012 to the charts we're watching today. Now, the interesting thing is what I've been mentioning about the monthly charts this time around. One good thing is we've never closed on a monthly basis below the 20-month moving average of the Bollinger Bands, and we're right at it right now. Now, I think that maybe next week we will close under it for the first time, possibly, but it's held up there. But if we close below that next week and then have a couple more closes below it, we're probably going to go a little bit lower, and we're going to form a trading range for a while. And and the other thing I would note on the monthly chart, and I've said this before, is that on the MACD, on the momentum chart of the MACD, I felt that when we move down and eventually bottom, I don't believe we will go into negative territory. I think we will bottom around neutral at zero on the chart or just above it, which would be a positive, because if we go negative, it's going to be a lot worse than people think, but I don't think that's going to happen. So, but we have a ways to go. And the last point I would make is I can't believe how gold has held up with the way that these miners have gotten crushed. And you would expect eventually gold to go down commensurately in some way so that we have some lower prices here. And I think that may happen. And maybe the miners are telling us this. And I think we will go lower, but we'll see.
So, Doc, sounds like you think that the stocks are, again, preceding another move down, or at least leading the gold price lower. When you look at some of these daily charts and even some of the weekly charts, then looking for some near-term resistance, all eyes for gold really are on that, let's say, 1670 to 1680 level, which that flash crash about 2 weeks ago took us right down to that level. Do you think that's going to hold? It definitely sounds like you think that's going to be tested.
Yeah, I think that's going to be tested again from what I'm seeing. I don't know how we can avoid it. Now, the question is, if we have a close be below that, it's I think a very important level is going to be 1600. I think if we can keep our closes in the months ahead above that, we're in good shape. We don't want to close any month in the future below 1600, Corey. That's what I'm looking for. We're going to start to with the Bollinger Bands on the monthly, they're going to start to turn laterally here pretty soon, and we're going to start to have it looks like a trading range. If we're going to go higher, it better be really quick here, because otherwise we're going to be in a trading range.
Well, Doc, let me just follow up on that point, because the 1673, 1677 March lows, they were tested for a third time. Generally, when a level gets tested a fourth or fifth time, it's going to break. So the worry would be, okay, we break that level, you know, are we now in a more confirmed cyclical bear market within a larger secular bull market? And Dave Erfle, in a discussion with him just earlier this week, he mentioned that 1550 level as strong support. And if people recall, that's where things really broke down back in 2013 in the bear market, where they really cascaded down and they got into the 1300s and 1200s eventually, and then all the way down to 1050. By the end of the bear market. So he sees that level as critical. Do you think that we could still break that 1600 level that you were saying would be bad and get to 1550 and hold and still retain the larger bull market trend overall?
I do think we can. And I'm not concerned about a break here where we move back down toward 1200, 1300. I don't see it. Things would really have to get bad globally for that to happen. We would have to have a 1929 type of conventional market crash, in my view, to see that happening. So I don't see that happening at all based on what I'm watching on these long-term charts. Because before that ever happens, if there's fear from a conventional market meltdown, you're going to see money printing like you've never seen before in our lives. And that in itself, I think, would be extremely positive for the precious metals, particularly gold.
Well, another thing to think about, and I've posted a chart like this on the site a few times, if you look all the way back, we still have this pattern of higher lows in place, you know, from the 1100 area to the 1260 area. And then in November of 2019, 1446, the flash crash during the pandemic was down to 1450. So even if gold were to break that 1670 level and bottom, let's say in the 1620s or above that 1550 support, we'd still have the overall longer term pattern of higher lows, which is still bullish. But if those were to break, obviously all bets are off, but is there a case to be made where gold does base over the next couple of months and then dig its way back out. It may not be a giant V-shaped rebound, but what do you think the exit of this and into the bull market will look like? Will it be something that takes months, or will it take a year?
Well, yeah, I think what we'll do is we'll find a bottom. I've been saying this in the first quarter of next year. Maybe it might even extend for gold, and I'm not talking about the miners. For gold in the first quarter of next year, or the first half of next year, I think we'll basically see the bottom. And then I think we can trade sideways for a while to build a base and be consolidated. And if you remember back 2011-12, as we moved down in gold, I said we'd see a U-shaped market for a while, and that's what we did see. And but I think we might get that again to a degree, but I don't think it'll be the length that we saw from the 2011-2012 meltdown. We were in that bottom of that U for about 5 years, approximately 5 years, almost 6 years. This time, I don't think that's going to happen. We could be in a bottoming phase in part of 2022 and 2023, but I think that would be it, frankly. I think by 2024, I think we're going to move and challenge those highs and move higher. And I don't think it's going to be later than that, Shad.
Doc, I hate to bring this up, but you brought up 2011, 2012. There are some similarities on these charts. If you go back to the peak in gold in 2011 to that initial bottom when it was correcting in about mid-2012, where gold corrected to 1526, that was 9 months. And then it took another 11 months for that low to be broken again after another bounce. You look at the correction that gold's been through here from the peak to the bottom this year in March, that was 8 months. So we're only a month off, and now we're only about 6 months past that time. Doc, can we rule out, unfortunately, a bear market starting similar to what we saw about a decade ago?
No. In fact, this, like I said, you can transpose this monthly chart almost exactly on the 2011-2012 chart. And but if we can, if that 12 month can hang in with the 26 month and stay fairly close to it, we're not going to see a vicious sell off. But if that thing drops out of bed like next month or October, like it did in 2013, early part of 2013, where you had a separation of pricing of the 12 month and 26. You're going to see a cascading low, or you're going to see that gold price cascade low just like it did back in 2013. So the next 2-3 months are going to be extremely informative on whether we see a considerable drop in the gold price or whether we continue to grind just lower and hold at the 1550 area. So the monthly chart is so important right now. The weekly and the daily charts tell you nothing, but the monthly chart just speaks volumes here.
Well, just to give people a glimmer of hope, I'm going to throw out the other idea, which is, besides the fact that we could be setting up for a confirmed bear market, there's the other school of thought in the bullish case that says we're in this giant cup and handle from 2011 to 2020. Where the 1921 peak in 2011 and the 2089 peak make the big top of the cup and this big rounded bottom you discussed, Doc. But then there's the handle, which we've been in. And some people, like Jordan Royburn mentioned, the handle may take longer to form than people think. Could this still, this weakness we're seeing and this downward channel since last August, still be part of that handle that is yet to form on that massive 10-year chart? And could that still be a bullish pattern overall?
Absolutely. In fact, if it plays out the way I talked about, that you don't go below a neutral on MACD and you go toward 1600 and 1550, and then you hang around there a little bit in 2022 to 23 and then start up toward 2024, you've got a beautiful handle, and it's probably going to be a stronger handle based on the length of time. So that can still hold true at this present time, and that's a very strong possibility yet. And that's why I feel that everybody shouldn't get completely depressed here yet. And it's going to be tough the second part of this year. And those guys that were talking about going to new highs, I don't know where they got that idea, but there's no way that's going to happen. And so it's going to be a tough end of the year here, and then we'll see what next year brings. But yeah, that cup and handle is still in play, even if we go lower here and then turn sideways for a couple or a few months and then start our move up. So it is still in play.
Yeah, that is a very good point, too. So something, again, that you can look at on the positive side of things. Right now, it's just, it's been a tough market, and let's see where price action takes us. As you said, Doc, I do want to quickly ask you about fundamental factors, too, because we do talk about fundamentals, and quite frankly, there's a lot of fundamentals to chat about. The ones that I think are most important here is what's going on with the economy. So underneath what the economy here, inflation data has peaked, which also means that real interest rates have bottomed, at least for the near term. And boy, oh boy, did they bottom in negative territory. And we also need to look at Fed policy. COVID is another thing we can talk about, but that's so variable. And that's just all over the place that right now, when we look at Fed policy, looks like the Fed is now talking about tapering this week. When you put that all into context, inflation peaking, real interest rates starting to climb again, maybe the Fed tightening, to me, that's almost everything going against gold, which isn't necessarily a bad thing considering where gold is trading. But what do you take away from the fundamentals, and which ones do you think matter the most?
Well, I think, and I said this, that we would, I agreed with the Fed a number of weeks ago when they said inflation might be transitory, and I said that. And I feel that we're going to enter a disinflation period here. And all that means is your rate of change of inflation is going to slow down. It doesn't mean that we go negative. That's all that means. And I think that's a real possibility, because I don't think this economy is as strong as people would like. And I think some of the variables are starting to show us that. And that means that growth isn't going to be what they expect it to be. And I say that because all this stimulus ends by the end of the year. And then we'll see what kind of economy we have. And what's interesting is the Fed's talking about tapering. Well, I think we're going to see signs of slowing before they make that decision. Then the decision is, do they taper into a slowing economy or do they back off? And this will take a few months to play out. And I think that even if they start to taper, they're going to have to reverse just like last time again. And then if we have the kind of slow economy I think is possible, you're going to have money printing again. And I think that's when I think gold could really make a move at that point in time.
So, Doc, yeah, I was going to ask you along those same lines. So just to reiterate what you're saying there, you're saying that let's say that they actually start the tapering. They pull the punch bowl away from the party and they start dialing back their bond buying. And maybe they go from $120 billion a month down to $90 billion a month. But if that happens and they stop buying bonds, I don't know who else is going to want to buy them. So that'll force the rates up. Interest rates will go up. And if interest rates go up, that usually pressures the general stock markets. So if the markets have a taper tantrum like they've had in 2013 and like they had a mini one in 2018, and the Fed does have to say, just kidding, we're going to come back and start buying bonds again, you think that could be the real driver there? That could be the catalyst that we're waiting for in the gold market?
Yeah, because that completely reverses their narrative again. And something interesting that I've noted on the TLT, which is a 20-year Treasury bond ETF, I don't see a lot of strength in that right now. That's had that's had 5 months of higher closing prices, but I think that thing is starting to look a little weak right now, which I find interesting, and that doesn't make sense to me right now. But the charts are kind of saying that there's not a lot of strength to the bond market right now, which I find to be interesting.
All right, Doc, let's move to portfolio management then. First, what have you been doing with your portfolio? Have you been a seller? Have you been buying anything? Or are you simply sitting on your cash?
What I done is 3 weeks ago, I sold a couple of my positions where I had made money, but their pricing at the point I sold was not looking favorably to me. Their charts weren't. And one of them I'll share with you was New Gold, where I sold down at about $1.80 or $1.70. Now it's down to $1. I'm glad I sold it because I had made a profit over time in it, and I had quite a position in it. And another one was NovaGold. So my portfolio now, my percentage invested in precious metals, I'm back into the 30s%. And I have quite a few exploration companies. Well, they don't have much further to fall on a percentage basis. They've, you know, they're about where they're going to be. Plus, I haven't a lot of loss in them because I bought them at low prices. But where I'm going to focus on going forward is I'm going to focus in on the producers. I'm going to focus in on some of the good royalty companies. And that's where I'm going to put my big positions in to prepare for the next move as we go forward. And I'm buying nothing right now because I think the next few weeks are going to be problematic. One good thing, though, is that the weekly on the gold charts doesn't look too bad, but the monthly still looks tough. And so I always go with the long-term charts as far as trend, even though the weekly looks okay. I go with the long-term because that often turns out to be right. So I'm just in a holding pattern. I'm in a lot of cash. I'm just waiting. And I will be purchasing in the future when I believe this thing has bottomed.
Well, Doc, when you say when you believe it's bottomed, will you be looking more for gold price to confirm that it's breaking up the new levels? Or will you be looking at the miners and looking at indexes like GDX or GDXJ to see if they are leading the track higher? What will you be looking for when things have bottomed and when you think that generalist money is going to start coming back in the space?
I'll look to the miners because the miners have gotten hurt so badly that I think gold is going to lag in price. And I think the miners, some of the producers will probably perk up before gold does. And that's what I'll be watching, Shad. And when I think some of these producers have bottomed, that's when I'm going to purchase them regardless of gold price. And that's what my plan is. And also some of the mid-tiers, that's what I'm going to wait, because those are the ones that will really do well out of the gate the next time. And it'll take the GDXJ and the juniors a little bit longer. And that's what my plan is. But I will be buying some of the juniors that I like from a speculative standpoint. And I'll do it based on charts again.
All right. Hey, Doc. Great having you on the show. I hope you all enjoyed this weekend's edition. We really did focus, again, with a lot of private investors here, trying to make sense of this continued correction. Now, everyone, please keep in touch. Our emails are fleck@kereport.com and shad@kereport.com. We love hearing from all of you. We really have been focusing more on company interviews and also a lot of webinars. Those will keep rolling out. So please keep on visiting our site, kereport.com. And hey, everyone, have a great weekend. Doc, really appreciate your time. Thanks again.